This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 4th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Canada's print market, like so many others around the world, has found itself in new territory over the past few years. But where some magazines have folded, others have sprung up in their place, and more print publications are now diversifying their offering, from hosting trade shows to lecture series to opening storefronts, all based on their publication's core themes. This week's special edition of The Stack from Monocle's Toronto Bureau talks all things Canadian print. Today on The Stack, we hear from the editors of three of Canada's most interesting magazines to assess the state of magazine publishing in this country today. We'll speak to the new editor of The Walrus, Canada's only national current affairs monthly.
Since 2008, a lot of parts of the United States have become decrepit, while Canada in general has become a richer place. And that has had a pronounced effect on Canadian psychology because we no longer look at the United States as our rich cousin.
That was John Kay, the editor of The Walrus, and we'll also be talking to Sarah Fulford, the editor of Toronto Life magazine.
The beauty of Toronto, where you have 100,000 new people moving into the city every year, is it's positively exploding. And in the midst of all that energy are a million fantastic stories for us.
That was Sarah Fulford of Toronto Life magazine, and a bit later in the program, we'll be talking to Matt Blackett of Spacing magazine.
The print is something that's important because it lasts for a long time. It's in people's washrooms, it's in people's coffee tables, it's at their cottage, it's wherever. And I think that there's something so important about the authority and the definitiveness of print.
All that and much more besides on the special edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show coming to you today from Toronto. Hello and welcome to the special edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé, coming to you from Monocle's bureau here in Toronto. Fearless, witty, thoughtful, Canadian. That's the tagline for The Walrus, Canada's most recognizable current affairs monthly. It was founded in 2003 and in the 12 years since has cemented its place as one of the only national current affairs monthlies in the country. From in-depth national reporting to long-form international reportage, The Walrus has a new editor in the form of John Kay, and I'm delighted to say that he joins me now. For listeners who might be sitting in Australia or the US or even in the UK, just set up The Walrus for us. It's a name I've always loved since it came out, just because of what it presents as this beast, friendly, sometimes rather fearsome as well. Whenever I've brought it back and people have seen it in the office in London, I've, in shorthand, John, I've always said it's the New Yorker of Canada. Is that fair?
It certainly aspires to be the New Yorker of Canada. The articles in it, I think, are the best in Canada for what they are. It'd be wonderful to have the resources of the New Yorker, which we don't have. But it is certainly Canada's most ambitious magazine when it comes to publishing long-form pieces, investigative pieces, in-depth arts and letters pieces, and it's a real honor to have been picked to edit the magazine.
If we look at the state of the Canadian print marketplace right now, we have newspapers ownership in flux, a very live situation, I guess, right now. You're still at the National Post. They've gone and swallowed up Sun newspapers in this country. I believe it's just been approved by the mergers and competitive authorities in this country. At the same time, we still have a strong national daily in the form of the Globe and Mail. There is a big city newspaper that behaves a little bit like a national newspaper in Toronto in the form of the Toronto Star. Is it still a good day for journalism in this country? And I guess we have to compare and contrast south of the border. Does it feel a little different, or are you in the same battle here?
It's very difficult for journalists in this country because I think, you know, I got into journalism, I guess, almost 20 years ago. And those days you could get one job and stick with it and make decent money, and you could even pay your mortgage on it. And these days, when I see young journalists getting into the profession, they typically have to do three or four things. They have to hustle as freelancers. Often they'll get radio shows. They'll do work on the blog. They might manage social.
Radio shows are nice.
Radio shows are
nice. Nothing wrong with those.
Nothing wrong. But they have to stitch things together.
Sure.
That's what's tough for today's journalists. Yeah.
If I look at, and I've spoken at some schools in this country since I left, is the focus still, if you grew up in Calgary or you grew up in Halifax, that one day you end up in Toronto or maybe you go to Vancouver. Is it still the attraction of the big city here? And I guess the second part of that is, are young Canadian journalists looking abroad enough as well? Because I sort of have the sense sometimes that it's... And even when you speak to a lot of people in government and elsewhere, people sort of say that young Canada is not traveling as much as maybe we did when we grew up. And I'm not sure if that's true or not, but the evidence seems to point that way.
You know what? If people aren't traveling as much as they used to, it might be for a healthy reason. When I was younger, ambitious people left Canada. They went to New York or they went to London because it wasn't considered first rate if you made a career for yourself in Canada. And this was true in all sorts of fields. I think that's changed. I know a lot of smart people who, in my generation, the first thing they would have done is taken a job in New York or gone to law school in the States or gone to Oxford or something like that. And a lot of those smart first-rate people are staying in Canada. It doesn't mean that they're less worldly, they're less sophisticated. I think it means there are more first-rate opportunities in Canada. And Canadians...
But then why is it difficult then?
Well, journalism in particular is difficult all across the world because it's a secular decline all across the world because of the challenges of the internet. But relative to other countries, when I talk to people who are journalists in the States compared to Canada, I would say that in relative terms, you go back a quarter century, Canadians in this field as well as in other fields, they're just more confident that they can achieve the first rate of professionalism of quality in Canada compared to the United States or Britain.
What are the forces that allow that, do you think?
Well, the forces, I think, have been economic. Western Canada in particular, you've had obviously the oil boom, and a huge factor was the 2008 financial crisis, which has had a huge psychological effect in Canada because we weathered that well, the United States didn't. And I think it reversed the inferiority complex that Canadians had with regard to the United States because since 2008, a lot of parts of the United States have become decrepit, while Canada in general has become a richer place. And that has had a pronounced effect on Canadian psychology because we no longer look at the United States as our rich cousin. We look at them as an equal partner. And if you're a young person, you're looking at your job prospects, psychologically, there's less impulse now to say, well, if I want to be a big shot, I have to go to the United States. I think that's a big deal for people like you and me who are always on the lookout for Canadian talent. Mm. We can convince them to stay in Canada and have great careers.
Let's maybe move the meter from print publishing, but I do want to come back to it. If we look at the state of broadcast journalism, last weekend we saw an accident in Halifax with an airliner belonging to Air Canada. I was amazed. It happened at a not the best hour for broadcasting. It happened just after midnight on the East Coast. But I was riveted. I just landed. And when I tuned into the main broadcaster, CBC, I was, and then throughout sort of the next sort of 10 hours, I was very surprised by the quality of coverage and I'll say poor quality of coverage. It really sort of felt like it was, let's get the interns out there. Maybe it was only the interns, but here you had a very, very significant event, but no one felt like they were on their game. And it didn't feel like the CBC that I once knew. And I'm wondering, do you think that's fair?
I think it's true that television in general is fantastically expensive to produce. And that's why in no other medium is the difference between amateurish and first-rate media more apparent than in television. We just saw the demise of Sun TV, Sun News, here in Toronto. One of the reasons that no one watched Sun News is because when you watched it looked like community access.
Right.
You can produce a really good monthly or quarterly magazine on a relative shoestring if you have good people working for you, but you can't do that with television. Cheap television always looks like cheap television. And the CBC has weathered a lot of cuts lately. And at a certain point, you get to a stage where you cannot cover big stories across this big country on a timely basis with the resources you have. What I've written is that I think for a public broadcaster, I think television in the age of the internet is a dead end. My view has always been that CBC should take its resources and put it into radio, because radio is something that CBC could do at an NPR level. It could do at a BBC level, but it can never do television at a level of international excellence. And in the age of the internet, I don't think they should do that. I think 10 or 15 years from now, CBC television will be largely defunct, despite the great history it has.
Would you like to see the Walrus having maybe not a prominent place, but a place on newsstands in Sydney, Australia, that it should appear, whether it's beside the New Yorker or the Spectator, in London? Because I think this is one of the interesting things. You know, Canada, maybe we don't play the same role that we did on the diplomatic stage once upon a time. But as you said, major brands that from a business point of view are certainly, they have muscle internationally, no question. from a film point of view, music point of view, we're doing something. I'm always slightly dismayed that I can find good Australian magazines in London, whether you like the Smith Journal or Frankie. There's a lot of things that have managed to sort of make it elsewhere in the world out of Australia. But for some reason, what is it about Canadian magazines that we simply haven't been able to be on a global stage? And I'm comparing ourselves to Australia because I think the experience is a little bit aligned.
Sure. Australia is an interesting... I lived in Australia for a bit, and it is such a remote part of the world that they have no choice but to reach out internationally with their media. You know, in my day, you'd go backpacking through Europe, and every second person you'd meet was from Australia.
Because, hasn't changed.
Yeah. They reach out to the world out of geographical desperation. It shapes their culture, and they're a very outward-looking people in that respect. Canada's a little different. We're near the United States. The Walrus in particular is very different because we have a charitable mandate. The Walrus Foundation, which owns the Walrus magazine, is a charitable entity, and its charitable mandate is to describe Canada and its place in the world. And that mandate would probably be a little bit too narrow to make the Walrus a huge player outside Canada. Mm. So, you know, right now, my aspiration as an editor of the magazine is largely confined to the Canadian market. 10 or 20 years from now, who knows? I'd love to see us on sale at Heathrow. Right now, though, I think we're limited to Canada as our target audience.
Okay, we're opening up a new stand in London in May, I can promise you. Send us a couple of bundles, and we'll put them front and center. John Kay, the editor of The Walrus here in Toronto. You're listening to a special Easter edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Toronto. We're back after this.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, a special Easter edition of the program, and we're coming to you from our bureau in Toronto, where I'm joined by Sarah Fulford. Sarah Fulford is the editor of Toronto Life magazine, a title which I really grew up with. I came to this city, moved here in 1984, and I can just remember, even before I got to Toronto, Sarah, it was a magazine that I would even pick up in Ottawa. I would try to grab copies of it in Montreal, because Toronto was this incredible, dynamic place that was changing. It had a bad rap, but of course was cashing in on the very rapid decline of Montreal, and the magazine seemed to be loving it. And so I can just remember at the time my parents said we were going to be leaving Montreal stroke Ottawa and coming to Toronto. It was amazing the role that a magazine like this really sort of played in capturing the vitality of the city, you know, at that time. And I guess for city magazines anywhere, that they represent the day in and day out brand, but also I think, you know, the aspirations of new people coming to the cities. And I guess one of the things today, when I'm back in Toronto, you know, many decades later, you just see the rate and pace of change. If you look at the skyline, you know, the city was always diverse, but even more diverse. And you've been in post, you know, for a while now, and I'm wondering, is that a challenge for you when you see so many new people coming to the city? How do you actually make your very own magazine an essential part of their month?
I'm so glad Toronto Life played that role in your life. I see all of this rapid growth and development expansion of the city as a tremendous opportunity for the magazine. Toronto Life has been around for almost 50 years. We'll celebrate our 50th anniversary next year. And I can imagine what it would be like to preside over a city magazine at a time of a city's decline. And I imagine it would be really no fun at all. Let's say you were editor of Detroit Life and you were chronicling. I mean, I'm sure there are great stories coming out of Detroit right now. But the beauty of Toronto, where you have 100,000 new people moving into the city every year, is it's positively exploding. And in the midst of all that energy are a million fantastic stories for us. So I see, if we're doing our job right as Toronto Life, we are both sort of irresistible and indispensable. We provide a kind of essential service. We tell readers about amazingly cool stuff out there. And we are also, I hope, grabby. So you see a copy, oh my God, I've got to read that story. Both those things, if done right, should reach and do reach a wildly diverse demographic.
Are you still talking to, or do you still rely on maybe that heartland of maybe people who hit their stride in the city in the 90s, you know, early 2000s? Or do you feel that you also need extra hooks to get the new tens of thousands, 100,000 people who come to the city every year as well? I'm wondering if there's sort of a challenge where kind of old Toronto, and I think you still, I don't know if that's fair or not. I mean, I still sense there is an old Toronto, and then where sort of a new Toronto takes off.
One of the interesting things about the city right now is the vitality of the downtown. And so you see people pouring into the downtown. And that's been a sort of through line of the magazine over the past 5 or 6 years. We have massive condo towers. We have whole new financial districts opening up. And people are coming there from all over the world. What a lot of our readers have in common is a very, very deep engagement with the city. So you're going to pick up Toronto Life if you eat out at restaurants. You're going to pick up Toronto Life if you go to more cultural events, if you actually pay money to go consume culture. Mm. These are some of our subjects. If you're engaged with politics in the city. And I find that the downtown core is a huge new audience for us. If anything, people who read Toronto Life have a little more disposable income than the average newcomer. On the other hand, we had a cover story a few years back on the sort of new global elite that's moved into Toronto. So what they share is a passion engagement with the city. And they may be from Mumbai. They may be from Vancouver.
Mm. Just before we went to the break, John Kay from The Walrus was talking about the challenges of journalism today. And just, you know, whether you're running a magazine or a TV outlet, whatever it is, the boom in Toronto, does it make it for interesting times when maybe newspapers aren't doing so well in the city, even though you could say that the Toronto Star made a bit of a global name for itself and people maybe didn't even know about the Toronto Star, but certainly, you know,
after the former mayor,
even though I'm looking at a nice cover here of the new mayor, John Tory, and your December 2014 cover. But I'm wondering if, two things, difficult for journalistic establishments, editorial establishments right now, and I guess also opportunity, though, when newspapers are in flux in big North American cities.
So there's a good news, bad news story for Toronto Life. Sure, our advertising revenue is down. Our digital revenue is climbing like crazy, and we have huge online engagement. The good news part of it is that monthly magazines actually retain their readership. We do not have a readership problem at all. In fact, our newsstand last year, shockingly, was up, which is like people actually paying money for our printed product
like
on the newsstand.
Absolutely.
And I think that's because a monthly city magazine has always been a very different beast from a daily newspaper. We tell long-form magazine stories, in addition to all manner of delightful candy at the front and the back of the book and consumer information that is tremendously valuable and pleasurable. Mm. One thing, we actually did a financial analysis of the investment we were putting into our feature articles and whether this was, in fact, really worth it in the digital age when everyone has short attention spans.
I want to know, what does that metric look like? How did you do that?
So it was traffic and it was engagement, like how long people were spending with a piece. And as it turned out, it's a really good investment to spend money. Our feature articles, when they go on our website, are very, very well read. People read them to the end. Mm-hmm. And they're well read over a long period of time. People read them, come back to them. And, you know, there is a big burden on us to make sure we choose stories that are irresistible and grabby and hook you right to the end and have the kind of deep research and reporting that makes the storytelling possible. But we don't believe at Toronto Life that we need to have a race to the bottom in order to get eyeballs. In fact, we've always believed that the magazine should be delicious and irresistible. A 5,000-word feature should also be delicious and irresistible. And if you have respect for your reader and you think, like, their time is worth something and we're not going to bore them and we trust that they want to be educated and feel smarter at the end, but we also know that we are in competition with every other thing that can grab their attention. So you have to be really good. And when you are, people spend time with you.
Hmm. Sarah Fulford from Toronto Life, thank you very much. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 Special Easter Edition. We're back in a moment.
Spring is springing, and it's time to take a close look at how we present ourselves. Our new style survey sits alluringly in our new April issue and will help guide you to the brands, retailers, and designers you need to know to smarten up your act. Here's what our editors have lined up this month.
In culture, we're in Paris with Savoir Faire, a record label and one-stop creative shop for artists, musicians and directors that might just point to the future of the music industry.
In the design section, we cross the Irish Sea to visit the Emerald Isle. There we meet some old greats and new favourites who are trying at long last to put Ireland on the design map.
In the edit section, we climb aboard a seaplane in Sydney for Donna Hayes' last meal, take a pit stop in Pittsburgh for this month's property prospectus, and step out in Somerset with a specialist cane maker.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or become a subscriber. Head to monocle.com to join the club.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Toronto this week. And as we said a little bit earlier, the pace of change in Toronto's cityscape is hard to escape at the moment. This is now a cityscape punctured by the silhouettes of cranes as Toronto's condominium boom continues apace. Well, one magazine that has tried to capture what kind of city Toronto should be is Spacing. Founded in 2003 and published four times a year, it bills itself as the only magazine to dig deep into urbanism in Canada's major metropolises. And I'm delighted to say that Spacing's co-founder, Matt Blackett, joins me now. It's actually interesting, Matt, because about 2 years ago, we were actually recording this program in the CBC studios here in Toronto before we were all grown up and had our own tiny space here in this part of the city. And it was great because someone brought Spacing out and just said they thought it was one of sort of Canada's shining examples and really were upholding it as an interesting international example as well, that there should be more Spacings elsewhere in the world. So just take us back a little bit. If I think about 2003 and, you know, we talk about the condo boom here, but it seems like it's never ended in this city. Right. What was the starting point for the title?
So it's quite funny because it really came out of a protest against the city trying to ban postering in the city. Something as like tiny and kind of arcane as that. But basically what was happening is the city had at the time a proposed bylaw that said you can't poster anywhere on the lampposts of our city. So that meant it was going to be about 90% of the lampposts, which seemed really kind of odd considering that at the time they were installing garbage bins all around the city that had corporate advertising on them. So essentially what they were saying was that, you know, Sprite, McDonald's, and real estate, you can advertise in the public realm of the city, but if you have a rock band, have a theater show, or you're a dog walker, you want to offer that service, that somehow is visual clutter, visual pollution. But that was actually the real local stuff, the stuff that actually gives you an idea of the vibrancy of what's going on in the neighborhood. And posters are, you know, that's how Martin Luther did it, right? It was about posters. And that's where it started. And it's still a very integral part of communicating what's going on, the culture of a city, the politics of a city. It's changed with Facebook and social media. Mm. But that was the impetus of this. And everything kind of has grown out of that original kind of protest against the banning of posters. And what happened is our advocacy work changed from being banned on 98% of the lampposts to being banned on 2% of the lampposts. So I think we did our job.
And did the form start as poster, then moving to stapling it together into a magazine? I mean, how quickly did that come about?
It was about 2 years. We had already been working on the campaign. And I guess basically what we realized was that there was a whole bunch of other issues, not just postering, that were really important to the city. So that meant, you know, cycling, infrastructure. It meant the streetscape and urban design of the city. It meant transit and development and all these things that kind of encompass life in the public realm of the city.
Mm. If I look at, this is probably the current issue, the winter 2014-2015, because spring's on its way to the printers right now.
Right now.
But you've tackled a favorite topic that my colleague Andrew Tuck, our editor, and also, of course, the host of The Urbanist, we like to talk, and he likes to talk about, and when he's not on air, we talk about tech in the city. Mm-hmm. And you know, here you've got, you've got maybe a Martian in a red flying saucer and speaking some gobbledygook to someone else. And a series of cover lines here, so which I find are fascinating. The promise of big data. Can we make smart highways? How cities have failed open data. And then, you know, walk the beat, pros and cons of cops on foot, etc. When I look at all of these, it seems like there's probably a manifesto below all of it. Do you give it all a good kicking, or does it get a fair airing in this magazine?
I think everything gets a fair airing. You know, we come at our topic from, you know, an advocacy standpoint, I believe, but that advocacy is what's best for Toronto. It's not about left, center, or right in terms of the political spectrum. It's about what we think is actually good for the city. I think, you know, we certainly tend to be a relatively progressive-minded publication, but I think that kind of the more you kind of dig down into the finer grain of what it is that cities do, it gets more progressive in terms of politics. It's about picking up garbage. It's about housing. It's about, you know, multiculturalism. It's about access to transit and mobility and these types of things. And I feel like, well, those aren't necessarily like left of center ideas. They tend to be embraced more from that kind of political spectrum of things.
Just before we go, it was interesting you talked about the intersection between the speed at which social media moves and maybe how that almost, it coaxes us into maybe a sort of a false sense of security almost as well, because suddenly you think that there was all this activism and something's also getting done. But as you said, governments move very, very slowly. Let's go back to paper. What role then does a quarterly magazine then play within all of that as well? I mean, do you think that you also have that time to contemplate that maybe, yes, if I'm just sort of, you know, blasting City Hall, or I'm trying to galvanize lots of opinion through a social media channel, this gives you a little bit more pause for thought? Or
I think, you know, Monocle and Spacing are kind of similar in some ways. We're a brand, right? And that brand includes a magazine, includes a website, includes.
And you've got a shop now.
You got a retail.
I know.
Like we're totally copying you guys. So, what I think with the magazine allows us time to think, step back, and provide a big picture about things. We use our website to kind of do news and react to things and provide kind of quick opinion. But the magazine and print allows us. I think you could go back and read some of our issues from a year or two ago, and they wouldn't seem out of date right now, because we try to position it in that kind of way. Because honestly, the newspapers and the kind of the news websites and the TV stations and radio, they all look after news. They react to things. Very few publications or media outlets actually think about things and analyze them and try to make sense of it. And that's really where we find our role. And we think that actually being four times a year is enough. It's great. You know, because we publish so much on the web as well, too. That, but I think the print is something that's important because it lasts for a long time. It's in people's washrooms, it's in people's coffee tables, it's at their cottage, it's wherever. And I think that there's something so important about the authority and the definitiveness of print that I know it's not going anywhere for us, and we're still doing okay with it. So,
Matt Blackett, editor of Spacing Magazine, is speaking to millions of converted listeners and readers around the world. That brings us to the end of the special edition of The Stack from our bureau here in Toronto with me, Tyler Berlay. Also, special thanks to our guests earlier, John Kay of The Walrus, and Sarah Fulford, the editor of Toronto Life magazine. Our producer today was Thomas Lewis here in Toronto, and our studio managers back in London have been Sam Impey and Chris Chilvers, and of course, Claire Urban helps things along as well. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time, and of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com, iTunes, or SoundCloud. But for now, for me, goodbye.